Welcome to the Resource People Podcast, presented to you by Australian Resources and Energy Group, AMA. The Resource People Podcast brings to life the stories behind the people, workforces and companies of our great industry.
Hi, Tara from AMA. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. I got to have a chat with Giles Lenz, who's the General Manager People, Health and Safety at Roy Hill. And for those of you that know Roy Hill, knows it's a massive iron ore organisation, but really quietly goes about its achievements and its operations. Really fantastic chat with Giles about a broad range of things, but lots of really good stuff around collaboration, around the culture and environment that they're developing, as well as the careers they're developing. Some really interesting perspectives from Giles on workforce strategy, design and mobility. Also some stuff that's a real challenge for the industry, retention of skills, and how to really encourage and attract people into the industry. So welcome to Resource People Podcast, Giles.
Thanks, Tara.
Wonderful. Can you get us started by telling us about your background and your role at Roy Hill?
Sure. So from my perspective, I was lucky enough to be given the opportunity to lead the human resources and safety function at Roy Hill since 2015. So joined more or less right towards the beginning of the project and was able to participate in us completing the actual, you know, what was nearly an $8 billion project that ultimately turned into a ramp up to 60 million tonnes and established us as the fourth largest iron ore producer in Western Australia. So a long way forth, but very proud West Australian business.
And it's been an absolutely remarkable story. You're just saying there, just only 2015. I know that many of us feel like we can't believe that we're this far through 2020, but it's really only been a number of years to become such a successful Australian company. Can you explain to us a little bit about Roy Hill, the background of the operations and how many people it employs here in Australia?
I think we were extremely lucky to get away when we did. It was a really good timing. You know, the ore body was there. There was a vision from our chairman, Mrs. Reinhart. There was an absolute burning desire to get the business up and running as fast as we could. I think the original partnership was really clever, you know, to be able to partner with Samsung in a way that we did, to be able to really effectively work with them. No scope creep on the business, really disciplined in executing the project. Being able to complete that to achieve first ore on ship, all of that, you know, I really think really worked in our favour. I think we ended up, you know, 23 days over, 23 days late and nearly $1 billion under budget. And there's not many multi-billion dollar projects that you get to achieve that. So I was really proud to be part of that. But then obviously getting into the operational ramp up. So right now, Roy Hill employs about 2,800 people directly and about 3,000 people indirectly. Our tonnage target this year is going to be 60 million tonnes. We're system constrained and port constrained to about 60 million tonnes. So that's, you know, what our output's going to be. But we're doing some work to make the business more efficient and more productive, which includes going to automated trucks over the coming years. So that's a big piece of the agenda item for us. I think one of the things that makes that exciting for Roy Hill is it's the first time we're going with an agnostic solution. So we're actually partnering with some brand new entrants to the automated truck category, but it's traditionally been quite a closed shop. So I think a number of people are watching us quite carefully to see how we tackle an autonomous solution that's actually agnostic. So that'll be interesting to work in that.
That's so interesting. And it's not the first time that Roy Hill has done things differently. As I mentioned in my first question, I want to come back to automation and technology, of course, because it really is dominating a lot of how we're driving efficiency in resource and energy. But just getting back to, you talked about the partnering and the ramp up, but with your experience, Giles, can you give us an insight into what do you think Roy Hill as an operation did differently as it was bringing itself to life from a workforce perspective than perhaps you'd seen working in other companies, in other industries?
I think one of the ways that Roy Hill differentiated itself was was the partnering that it did with a lot of our suppliers. I think I get a broad view that people that work with us either, you know, really in a partnering way, quite appreciate quite a lot the significant difference that that generates. So, for example, one of our partners is Orica, obviously in the provision of explosives, but we were one of the first people that they wanted to partner with to be able to explore what some technology improvements and production improvements might be. And I think there's a way that we differentiate ourselves that makes us more of an agency that people are prepared to work for, because we're prepared to try, I think, a little bit harder and a little bit more innovatively and a little bit more from a partnering perspective with people to be able to work with them in bringing solutions through to the workplace. I think that would be one.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the other one would be just in terms of the way that we built our culture in the workforce. And I think, you know, when I think about the way that we drive our culture in Roy Hill and the sponsorship we have with the chairman, I really like to think that we have a really differentiated workforce as a consequence of that. And, you know, what that results in is a fairly significant investment from people who are prepared to put in some discretionary effort. And I'd like to think that Roy Hill prides itself in being really outcome focused and has a lot of discretionary effort from its people because of the culture that we've built here. So,
That's fascinating, because my observation over, you know, the last kind of 5-6 years has been an impression of Roy Hill's people and culture that it has a really can-do attitude, but the organisation also quietly goes about your achievements. Do you think that's a fair assessment? And what would you say, further than what you've already said, about the culture that you guys have been developing?
Yeah, we've got a couple of, strap lines, I suppose, that reinforce our culture. But our prime values is lead, care, think, perform. And I think our people quite often lean into that to turn around and look for solutions. I think also, you know, the underpinning model that exists in Roy Hill is called our integrated operating model. And what the integrated operating model calls for is a really high level of collaboration and a real drive for what is the challenge we're trying to solve and what is the collaboration that needs to be in play for us to go to where the bottleneck is, solve what the business issue is, and then continue to optimize the throughput through all of our systems. I think the other thing that goes, we spend a lot of time working on our systems and what it means to be successful in a systems model. And one of the big pieces in the systems model is there's no room for egos. Right, because it's all about achieving what's best for business. And I think a lot of our people genuinely participate. They understand the principle behind what it means to be in a system, what it means to subordinate to the bottleneck, what it means to actually make the systems work in the way in which they should, in a way that means that we always deploy our resources as powerfully as we can. And I've been really proud of the rapid decision making and the rapid problem solving and the ability that our employees have to be able to collaborate to get the best solution. So I think that's been a real differentiator for us, particularly as we've been ramping up.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that really leads me to asking you a couple of questions about COVID, talking about collaboration, talking about that, you know, systems and making sure that there's that throughput and decision-making, et cetera. So can you tell us about, you know, has COVID-19 impacted Roy Hill and in which ways? And, you know, what has been the collaboration that's been required to really manage the workforce and the workforce impact of this pandemic?
It certainly has been a real challenge for us. And I think right from the beginning, we felt we had a higher risk profile. And what I mean by that is, you know, we've got one mine and one port, one railroad and lots of, you know, interdependencies. But if we had a pandemic outbreak at the mine, it's a lot more severe for us potentially than some of the other mines that might have, you know, 19 or 20 mines like a Rio. So we really wanted to, wherever we could, absolutely minimise our risk. But where I think it began very much was from a leadership perspective. And I think we had a really high degree of instrumental leadership, both from our leadership within the company, and more specifically that was Barry Fitzgerald as our chief executive, but also from the chairman herself. So Mrs. Reinhart was extremely passionate about making sure that we responded to the pandemic in the most powerful way that we could, and was absolutely actively involved in helping us, you know, respond and source or make the changes that we needed to make to be able to respond. So, you know, really early on with all of the pieces around the health and safety responses and the masks and the testing, and, you know, the chairman was right there with us all through that, as well as I think symbolically Barry was very forthright in terms of doing his thinking work. And then I think we really put some things into play that really helped us be able to manage it. And one of them was, you know, the early formation of our COVID-19 response team. And certainly I've had some feedback from some of our partners, and in particular Compass Group, which is, you know, a big global player in the food services business, you know, globally around the world. And really early on, we set up our response group and invited them to participate. And I think we were ahead of the curve by a fairly significant way, especially compared to their global operations, which has subsequently been, you know, significantly hit. So I know I've had some personal feedback from that group that said, from their perspective, how amazed they were that we were so far ahead of the curve in terms of being able to be ready around our responses and trying to understand what was happening. So that was really, you know, a great recognition, I think, because, you know, I think globally they've got about 400,000 people, and the fact that we, you know, stood out to them as a group that was really thinking ahead in terms of what might impact the business and the kinds of things we put in play. So a lot of the site protocols involved a lot of work with people like Compass and ISS, who are our camp providers, to be able to maintain social distancing and do all these really different things at site that meant that COVID wouldn't take. And they were... They absolutely harvested a lot of the approaches that we took with them at our site in Port Hedland and took it into their other camps around Australia. So I like to think that the really early work that we did had a profound impact on protecting the rest of the industry, because you know, we were able to communicate through them as to how we should do it. So
setting a benchmark, but again, another example of collaboration and partnership, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, just on that, probably my last question around COVID-19 is that companies have been seeking out, you know, all different types of efficiencies, whether it is through their corporate offices, whether it's to do with the kind of movement of people on and off site. Has there been any examples of things that, you know, you've had to develop and respond to as part of COVID that you're seeing as something that you could adapt into your operating model going forward?
So there's a couple of things that I think have been good or represent ways that we want to work in the future. I mean, one of the first things is that obviously within a really short time period, and I think, you know, we initially went to panel working with our Perth-based Rock office, and then pretty much we were working from home probably within a week. And there was a really the technology team, you know, I had to take my hat off to the technology team. They really went quickly on how we could set up all the safety protocols and all of the security protocols necessary for people to be able to work from home. And then, you know, an early decision was made, which I think a lot of businesses have made globally around moving to Microsoft Teams, which we're now on. And I must admit there are some scenarios and some meetings that you have right now that the nature of Microsoft Teams and the egalitarian nature of that doing business that way means that everybody gets a fair say. So I think there's some aspects of that I'll continue to use in our business going forward, where just the absolute reality is that you're better off having a meeting over Microsoft Teams because it gets a slightly better outcome. So that would be one. I think the other one is, you know, when I kind of go on a macro, more of a macro look, we've just come off the back of the best quarter that we've ever had production-wise.
Oh, so, congratulations.
We had an outstanding result. We had an objective to get, you know, 15 million tonnes, which is our tonnage target rate on a quarterly basis. And we absolutely went past that. And we reflect on what are some of the things that meant that we could do that, and that are linked to COVID, because, you know, we had this challenge that was in that. And, you know, one of the things that we did in that is we actually moved to a most people move to a 2-2 roster, a longer cycle roster. We actually moved to a 4-4 roster. And if you said to me, in my lifetime, would I ever move my business to a 4-4 roster? Would we do that? And we did that within, it was about 5 weeks it took us to get into a 4-4. Absolutely incredibly proud of our people and their willingness to go, no, we can understand why you want to do the most conservative roster you can, which you know, my read of the play and what's gone on in the market is no one else moved to a 4-4 roster. But our view was is that the longer cycle would give us even more protection. As it happened, we were lucky enough to go and do 2 4-week cycles and then move back. But I think the lessons learned, to go back to your question, the lessons learned were, you know, what is it that we can do for our leaders that means they've got nothing else that's on their minds and that they actually get the ability to focus in on production and focus in on, and there's less noise around them, mm-hmm. less noise about worrying about flights, less noise about worrying about, you know, where all their people are coming from, because, you know, a lot of external teams took away that load. And we're in the process now of going through a simplification process where we can try and, in essence, harvest all the best things from COVID and be allowed to set us up, you know, going forward so that we create that environment where there isn't this massive load on our leaders. They actually get to focus in on what's most important from a production perspective. And we get to set the systems up in play. I mean, one of the things we did as an innovation, just to share it with you, is we made a decision pretty early on to set up a call centre. Now, I haven't heard of anybody else setting up a call centre, but that call centre was stood up in 24 hours. And over the course of COVID, from our employees, we took over 3,500 phone calls, which, you know, and we were solving all of those problems with tickets about questions that people had and flights and you name it, we were solving it as part of the call centre. Now, what that did is it took a lot of the, imagine if those 3,300 people went had to go and ask managers. Those questions to their leaders and their managers, that's right. Mm. So we're convinced that one of the things that was the second order effect of that was giving us the headroom to be able to manage and go after our production, you know. And we're, but within that, you know, there was the challenge, which I'm sure other AMA members have had, which is, we've got a lot of interstaters and international employees, 310 people in total. We've had over 40 people who haven't turned up at all as a consequence of COVID and just made the decision not to come. So, you know, we've had a fair bit of pressure that's gone on the business and on the people that have been left to be able to do that.
Pick up the slack.
That gives you a bit of an insight into
it. It does, you know, but it also kind of gives an indication of how you were able to do those things and move to it. So, you know, touch wood that, you know, Western Australia remains in the state that is now, but when we're seeing the second waves in other states, knowing that you've been through that and you can move to that rapidly, and as you say, without that massive load on your leaders and managers. And just to ask about that, one of the things that companies are really looking at and focused on at the moment is of course people's mental health and wellness. And recently I learnt that 60% of someone's workforce, you know, the time they're in work, you know, wellness and mental health has to do with their direct supervisor. So it sounds like a really great strategy to be able to remove so much away from them in terms of logistics, et cetera, to get them just to really focus on production and their teams. Have you found that there's been things that you've done from a mental health and wellness for your workforce that has been useful or interesting or that's been, you know, really effective for you in the past few months?
Look, I think the main thing has been we have a vehicle that we call it's called the LLRC, which is the Roy Hill Learning Lifestyle and Recreation Community. But basically, it's the Roy Hill community is this vehicle that we lean into, and it's run both by people within the business and by volunteers, and they develop a lot of the strategies around how can we make the organisation look and feel like it's a really supportive organisation. And there's a bunch of things that we've done during COVID that meant that people haven't been impacted or confronted. We've got, you know, some of the things in play that you would expect, which is the ability to lean into some of the service providers and our EAPs and things like that. But outside of that, there's this much broader sense of community around things that we know that make life at site a lot easier, and things that we know that will impact on and our teams. We've reached out a lot to people at homes. You know, we've gone on purpose to people at their homes on a number of occasions just to communicate with them directly, talk to them about what we're doing. We've sent some of our COVID protocols and approaches back to homes specifically so partners could read about why what we're doing at site and why we're doing them. And I think people have really appreciated the inclusivity, I suppose, that we've pushed really hard to be able to reach out and make that a part. But I agree with you, the mental health part is still a significant concern for me, mainly because I think we're a long way from this being over. And I think, you know, there's a bunch of second order effects that we're yet to consider. You know, a lot of people, you know, particularly younger people, you know, really thrive in that environment where they can travel a lot, and our rosters lend themselves to traveling a lot. And you know, none of that's around at the moment, and it might not be around for a really long time. So we're seeing this really unusual displacement of what some people thought their life or life would be like, and I still think we've got to work through that. You know, I think the overall numbers of suicides is up around 600 people this time last year. So there's now no doubt in my mind that there's some significant mental health challenges for people. And I think, you know, my encouragement to everybody that would be listening would be whatever's required for us to invest more and understand this in a more profound way, we need to, reaching as far as we can to be able to make a difference, because I think that's a challenge that's still not defined into the future.
Still lots in front of us, and that profound change of lifestyle that you mentioned.
There really is.
Well, I really love what you're talking about in terms of the what you called the LLRC, that community-based initiative, because that's what really a lot of people, that's been what the biggest challenge has been, that they've got no community, or they're very isolated, or their lifestyle and their existing community has changed. So having that existing community in place that people can tap into or lean into, as you said, sounds like it, you know, something that you already had in place to be able to support people through such a big change like this. But I want to get onto technology and skills now. You mentioned the automated trucks, and I know with you guys managing your rail, and you've had your integrated corporate headquarters and remote operations centre, the ROC in Perth. You know, one of the things that people get very concerned about with automation, of course, and particularly plays out in the media and other social stakeholders, is the displacement of workers. And we know from a lot of other organisations, both here in Australia and globally, that that isn't necessarily the case in terms of the amount of roles that are required to manage automated fleets and automated elements of operations. But I'm really interested, Jaz, what kind of way has Roy Hill gone about working with its workforce and developing its workforce to be ready for this sort of change? There's a lot that goes into that, so I'm really interested in your insights.
Yeah, this is a fairly significant work stream for us. So so as part of the response to AHS, we've in my own team, I've got an entire team that's set up to support the evolution and the development of the AHS solution. And within that is, you know, a specific group that's working on my future at Roy Hill and their ability to be able to, in essence, as our primary customer, redeploy within Roy Hill. But we're actually trying to kind of create a much more broader sense in Roy Hill. And whilst AHS is our kind of first primary customer, we're really trying to get the message out to the whole workforce around what we're calling workforce mobility, and kind of underpinning workforce mobility is this nature of as long as you've got an appetite and a view to continuously learn, then we'll create the environment where you can continue to evolve your career and work in different parts of the business. And we're really trying to challenge ourselves around job design. And I recognise that some people who are, you know, absolutely going to be truck drivers and that's all they want to be is truck drivers, then I respect that. And ultimately they might part company with us as a consequence of the AHS. But there's another population of people, particularly some of our younger people that have joined us as new to industry. So Roy Hill's tried really hard to bring new people into mining. And there's not many people, particularly in our competitors, that have really got a pipeline of new people coming in. Now, the interesting thing is if you've got new people coming in, you've got to give them a line of sight to other opportunities in the future. So part of our mobility strategy and part of our workforce of the future strategy is that we've got to be really clear that there's opportunities for people to redeploy in other roles. And as long as you've got this kind of broad view around a willingness to learn new things and a willingness to retrain yourself and an opportunity that we've got and an open-mindedness. And it really is a mindset piece. You know, I'm constantly surprised by, you know, the frames that people have that says, you know, you've got to have this deep level of experience to be able to do a particular task. But when you really challenge yourself on how much time is needed to be able to become proficient in the role, it's certainly not years and years of experience. It's more like, you know, most of the roles that we've been working on in our business, it's somewhere between a 6 and 18 month period of time that people can be fully trained to be able to execute the role. And we've had some really, powerful examples within the business, which I think has already differentiated Roy Hill. That means that us working in this mobility space will continue to do well. One of the original employees from our exploration camp in Hancock, which is this lady called Pagan, and she was a cook in the exploration camp. And then she became an operator, and now she's one of our most experienced control room operators downstairs in the rock, you know, working in the remote operating center for port control. So it's just having this view that says, you know, there is got to be this mindset that says people can acquire new skills, and if some people are prepared to give them a break. And I'm glad that we've already got it in our DNA at the moment. It already exists for us, and I've just got to expand that more with my team, which I've got a really wonderful team that's really passionate about this workforce strategy and the mobility piece. That means that, you know, I'm really comfortable that we'll be able to redeploy a lot of our people that are currently driving trucks into other parts of the business. But then also as we evolve the business and we change the nature of the work, that we'll be able to get people to move into the different types of roles.
And I mean, it's so impressive, and you totally preempted some of my further questions, because, you know, I know that about Roy Hill, and I've always been so impressed by the fact that you've really just not just accepted the status quo about how people gather experience and become proficient, and you've really looked at work design and things like that to give people opportunities that for some period of time people thought, you know, there wouldn't have been a single job out there that didn't say at least 5 years on-site experience, and somebody had to really make the difference in that. And I believe you guys have really led the charge in questioning that status quo. And that really lends us to I really am interested in about the skills piece, because that's one of the things, you know, with the Australian, particularly vocational education training, that's been challenging for employers to be able to not just upskill people and give them those opportunities, but to be able to map that to, you know, the qualifications that are required, whether it's for a regulation perspective or all those other things. So I'm really interested to know whether there are any things that are happening in the skilling space. You know, the Prime Minister, it's, you know, one of the two big priority areas, along with industrial relations reform, that he's really moving forward on. So is there anything that you would say with the, you know, the dramatic work you're doing in terms of, you know, workforce of the future, the workforce mobility, that you would love to see Australia really embrace in terms of this reskilling that's required?
So I was particularly, so to, a couple of threads there. So I suppose the first thread I'll go with is, you know, how do I see West, what have I seen, what's actually in play that I see where people are making an effort? And I have been impressed by the West Australian Department of Training and Workforce and Development, because McGowan pulled them all in and said, you know, this, what are you going to do to make sure that we power our own economy? We've got a real challenge around our youth unemployment in WA, but in the next breath, you know, we're an absolute powerhouse in terms of the economy. So there has to be a preparedness to get young people into the industry. And in my view, over the last couple of months, they've tried really hard with, particularly led by the Director General, Anne Driscoll, and to really have a look at the worst workforce development in Western Australia. And I think we've got an opportunity to lean into some of that work that's going to come from that, where they're actually saying to us, you know, what is it that you really want us to be better at and do? And they've taken on board some of those challenges around, you know, the long burn traditional apprenticeships that that take 4 years to finish, that, you know, that in some cases, because we, you know, we don't have any currently, we don't have any junior apprentices. We've only ever offered adult apprentices as a mechanism of retention to our current people, right? And a lot of those people are highly skilled or have other trades themselves. So to put them through this kind of really narrow frame of, well, it has to be 4 years because that's the way it's always done. And absolutely what I've seen and or what I'm hearing at the moment, so that's why it's a bit of a watch it for me, is, you know, but I've got to have, you know, positive in mind, positive in spirit that they'll do it. I think there's a real appetite for the organisation to change and go, no, no, we're not going to continue to do it this way. We're actually going to try something a little bit different around the way that they're allowing some of the training to occur and some of the recognition to occur. So that's one piece. And then I also think them putting the money where their mouth is around the, you know, some of the infrastructure and some of the work. I mean, I've seen some good work that went into some of the mechatronics and some of the remote operations traineeships that exist. So we've got to make sure that we sponsor those programs and be prepared to line up with those programs and provide people to be able to participate in them or employ people from them. That would be kind of one piece. And then I think, you know, there's just this underlying accountability that I think every major employer has got that says, within my own strategy, you know, when I say my, I mean on behalf of Roy Hill, what are we doing to try and bring some younger people or some diverse people into our business? And the best example I can give you is that we every year we run a VAC student program. Now, we run a VAC student program because the vast majority of universities say, in order for you to graduate, you've got to do, you know, some vacation work, right? And it's actually a prerequisite that they've got to, you know, do it somewhere, right? Now, the ridiculous thing is when you go to the private sector or you go and go looking for where these kids can go and do the work that's necessary for them to be able to graduate, there's not very many opportunities, right? You certainly don't see, you certainly when you go looking, you don't see lots and lots of programs going, yes, this is what we've got in play. And last year, we made a decision to make sure, you know, we've been running it for a couple of years, but we pushed the boat out last year and we had 52 graduates. Wow. Right. And the criteria is they have to do meaningful work. They can't come here and sit in the corner and play on the photocopier. They've actually got to do something that's a meaningful project that's going to have a demonstrable impact on the business, whether our performance or our governance or our and improving the business. And whilst we'd love to take all of them on, we obviously can't, right? But we're absolutely doing our bit to make sure that some of those bright young professionals are work fit and understand what it means to come into a workplace and understand what it means to work in a corporate environment and hopefully prepare them to be able to be employed when they finish their degree. So that's
and
just
also want a career in our industry, because for some time that's been a little bit waxing and waning with commodity price cycles, hasn't it? So haven't necessarily had the depth and the diversity of people coming through a pipeline for our industry.
Yes, I agree. So I'm really proud of that program, and you know, we don't advertise it formally because, you know, via our 2,800 people, we invariably, you know, end up getting a whole raft of these people that come in and go, can we do some VAC work? And it's paid. So that's a really small example of, you know, we need to do more of that. We need to keep pipelining people so that they can get into the workforce.
I want to ask you a question about that because I know that there's some really fantastic programs that you sponsor, particularly about increasing awareness of younger children about what resources and what mining is actually really like, etc. But before I do, I just want to pick up on, you just talked about, you know, bringing a diverse group of people into your organization.
Yes.
With that 52 you know, VAC program and, you know, all of these different things that you do year on year, What kind of pool are you seeing? Are you seeing a gender change in terms of the number of females being attracted to our industry? It's been such a big challenge for our industry over a long period of time, and employers are trying so hard to really, you know, increase, you know, all different types of diversity, but principally gender diversity. So what are you seeing? Is it changing, or are we still needing to do so much more and continue that work up front to make sure that people are attracted to our industry?
Oh, look, I think it's a little bit like COVID. We can't be complacent about what we're doing, right? Because, you know, if we don't continue to really drive up the and particularly some, I think what we've done to a certain extent is we've got rid of some of the, you know, really obvious detractors, as in some, you know, some of those really, really obvious things that were really rate limiting for us to be able to get diversity in our industry. I'd like to think that some of those really kind of basic
infrastructure
frames,
things like hygiene and all those
infrastructure
sort of things.
Hygiene, just a basic way of doing business. There's not as much really negative environments for people. So I think we've done some of the basics, but I think we've got a way to go. There's some of the structural stuff that's still a challenge. I certainly think that we need to be a lot more flexible and have flexible working arrangements. And I think having site-based roles doesn't tend to lean into that. So I still think we've got some work to do where people become a lot braver around, you know, rosters and how they consider that from a diversity perspective, and how they do part-time and how they consider that from a diversity perspective. Because I still think we're leaving a lot of people off the table because we're not embracing that to the extent that we could. But I know, the VAC program that I mentioned, it had to be 50-50, which I really appreciated that design, because it then, and of that, 50% of the roles, diverse roles, had to be site-based as well. So we're trying really hard to change the dial and change the environment for people that are working up in those teams, and also working really hard, you know, because you know the impact it has just by creating an environment that's diverse around just the way the team operates and leads itself. And, you know, I think our leaders are really starting to embrace that now, where you've got a critical mass, you know, say a team that's 50-50, and just the difference it makes in terms of, you know, work environment. And that's been a really long time coming, but I still think we've got, you know, some more work to do than where we are, and we've got to change you've got to continue to challenge some of the paradigms that, you know, prevent that long-term solution and the long-term employment nature of being site-based. I think that's where our next wave of opportunity is going to become. And I think technology will bring some of that, right? As more and more of the roles come down to the rock, and more of the roles lend themselves to being run out of the remote operating centre, then there's an opportunity just in itself there to be able to create some extra diversity.
And track from different places. Well, it's certainly been the way that you guys have built Roy Hill. And I just want to, you know, I my observation over the years has been this real can-do attitude with Roy Hill, and led from the top. And I can add that now in terms of collaboration, because everything you've touched on today, you know, has really spoken to the way that you guys approach opportunities and challenges in terms of collaborations, whether it be with partners or generally with your workforce as you're going through very large changes like you are in terms of your workforce mobility program. So thanks so much, Giles, for sharing your insights and giving us a bit of a tour of, you know, what's happening at Roy Hill at the moment from a workforce and a people perspective. Thank you so much for your time and joining us on Resource People Podcast.
Thank you, Tara. I really appreciated the chance to talk to you, and, you know, clearly an opportunity to showcase Roy Hill. I think it's a wonderful West Australian company. I think we try to punch above our weight, and we've certainly tried to build a really proud West Australian company. So thank you very much for your time.
And no doubt we'll come back to you to hear how it's all going in coming months and years. Thanks so much, Giles.
Thanks, Tara.
Giles gave us some fantastic insights into what they're doing at Roy Hill, and particularly in the people and health and safety function. I hope you got something from it. I sure did. And really appreciate you joining us for this episode of Resource People Podcast, and hope you can join us again soon for another one.
Thank you for listening to the Resource People podcast. We look forward to you joining us next time as we highlight the many great stories of the resources and energy industry. If you have any questions about the podcast, please email media@ama.org.au. Produced by Brad Thompson.